And welcome, my name again is Mole Fetzile. This is the final of a series of lectures on the theme of faith and politics, or faith and struggle. I had hoped that I will use this final lecture to be a little bit theological in terms of showing the various theories that undergird the debate relating to how are we to live out our calling as disciples in the world of politics. How are we to integrate these two realms? It's an old debate which started especially when Christianity came into a political system that was foreign to it. And then you may remember that Augustine wrote a book many years ago entitled The City of God. They give that a day, and the idea of the City of God was to show that there is the worldly city and there is the divine city. And then the problem was that how are people who are still in this worldly city are to also be citizens of the divine city of God? And according to him, being a Catholic at that time, the church was supposed to be that representative of the city of God to people, and as a result, the people had to live out their faith according to what the church says. Now, that problem is continuing today, and I will show that in South Africa it emerges in a little bit different way than it emerges in America. In America, for an example, there is a religious pluralism. Many people of faith, Judaism, and people who just do not profess any faith. And there is also fundamentalism. What is happening on the South, for example, vis-a-vis evangelical groupings, is a form of Christian fundamentalism, in the same way that you have in the world today various forms of religious fundamentalism in Islamic countries. The demand, for an example, by certain fundamentalist groups, Christian fundamentalist groups, that the Bible must be taught in schools is not any way different to the demand by Islamic fundamentalists that the Quran should be the only thing that is taught. Now, in that situation, the question about how are we to live out our faith and be disciples in this situation becomes a very pertinent question. In earlier times, this was never a problem. The law of the land was also the law of the Bible, or the law of the Bible was also the law of the land. But today, when it is no longer clear whether is it right to pray at the commencement, is it right to pray at school, is it right? There has been a debate in Chicago which went to a court whether that a certain group called for a city called Zion, somewhere not far from Wisconsin, to be changed the name. So is it right to call a city like St. Paul, San Francisco, because other people think that that is an intrusion of faith into their secular realm? These problems, as we try to answer them, raises this American way of how does discipleship and citizenship overlap and relate to one another. There is an interesting case in Britain which was settled recently, which was brought to the court by a former rock star. His name is Cat Stevens. I'm not sure how many of you know Cat Stevens, who has become a Muslim and has changed his name. It's no longer Cat Stevens. And what he did is, you have, may have maybe familiar with the case. He brought a case that it is not right for the British schools to be, which are connected with the Church of England, to receive public funding. If they receive public funding, then all Muslim schools, which in Britain all of them are private in the same way as Jewish schools are private. He says if they, these ones receive private public funding, then even Muslim schools must receive public funding. And it became a big case in Britain. And the court settled that, you're sure, if the state is going to fund church schools, it must also fund Islamic schools. And as you may know, that Britain is a particularly is in a particularly difficult position, because you've got there the another formulation of this problem is what is called the throne and the altar. You've got the throne and the altar overlapping. If the Archbishop of Canterbury is elected, he must get approval from the Queen, from the throne, and it raises that serious that problem again. What are you to do as a Christian or as a disciple, and if you are also to respect these other traditions which are the result of your being a citizen of that particular order. There are many examples of besides what I've said about the American way in which this problem is being raised, from the debate of the flag in the sacristy to what should Christians do in the event of war. Many people, for example, still felt that because of their discipleship, they don't think that it is proper to respond to a call. The point is that there is no easy escape to this problem of dual citizenship, the citizenship of Christ as his disciples and the citizenship of where we are, of the political realm, and the political realm especially when you know that the citizenship of Christ is that citizenship which calls one for a life of you can say that of perfection. You are called to live out your faith in a way that has perfection in it. But the citizenship of the world is a very complicated citizenship that is fraught with compromises and thinking through problems and voting for the lesser of the two evils and doing all sorts. It's never clear cut or perfect. You may not want to do both of all the things, all the options you are offered, but you have to take one and you end up. Whereas in this other instance, it's a different type. Now, there has been traditional ways in which responses have been made to this problem, and the most easiest way is the one suggested by the Mennonite groups, the group who simply says that in all cases imitate or follow Christ. If you are called upon as a citizen, you are being asked to do something, just ask, what would Christ have done, and follow suit. In other words, the imitation of Christ model. And of course, the Mennonites, because of that model of relating discipleship and citizenship, therefore strictly believe that all disciples of Christ must at the same time also be pacifists. They must embrace non-violence and no war ways of resolving conflict, because they say that if you have to follow the example of Christ, there is no way you are going to say, let's settle this out in this way. Of course, people who are looking in this, they are saying that this is not a fair, it is not a complete answer, because there are many areas of life in which to ask what does Christ say, to follow the example of Christ, the guidance from Christ is very, very sparse. Christ doesn't say a lot on issues that we are confronted with today. You can search the Bible, the whole scripture, if you strictly want to say, let's follow the example of Christ. And so other people say, in the end, you're going to have to interpret what Christ had said on one thing to try and make it apply on other things. And that's where the Mennonite option. But the option itself is very impressive, because they are serious about it. They simply say that if you really want to be a disciple, even if in this world, ask first question, what does Christ say, and do that. The Reformed tradition, which is associated with the influences of Calvin and so on, and that includes, for example, to some extent, Presbyterian and many other Reformed churches, and to a very large extent, that is the tradition that has influenced the beginning of America. If you trace back the people who left Europe, they were a large majority of them were under the influence of this Reformed tradition, and that Reformed tradition is the one that says that the law of the Bible or the lordship of God should also rule on matters of citizenship. There is no way that you can say that on this issue, let's take out God. God has nothing to do with this debate. Either it's the debate on abortion or what. The Reformed tradition is basically say that there is only one law in the whole universe, and that is the lordship or the sovereignty of God. And that law, where do you find it? You find it in the Bible. And that is why a country like South Africa, you don't have sports on Sunday. You don't have business on Sunday, because it's a Calvinist country. Just follow the law of God. It tells you how you should organize your political life. One can go through all these models, like the how would the Catholics say, how would the Lutherans say. It's very interesting options of how each try to relate this. But then the point is that the problem remains there, simply because in calling ourselves disciples of Christ, in calling ourselves Christians, we do not thereby stop becoming British, French, American, South African, etc. In other words, that other life still remains. We are still citizens of a particular geographic sphere. And what is the implication of becoming? I used to ask many people I married whether is there a difference in them saying that what they are doing is Christian marriage and an ordinary marriage. Is there a difference between a Christian American and an ordinary American? What has the Christian adjective to do with the other realm? And that is an important debate now in other countries, whether can you have Christian education Or is all education the same? You just don't even have to say it's Christian. And that is the whole debate on this. It's still going on. And I am saying that debate is there for as long as you are going to have dual citizenship. And we saw that it started from the time of Saint Augustine. And therefore, part of our responsibility today is to be very clear about these issues and to find ways in which we can, with consistency and consciousness, continue to say we are disciples even in the midst of being citizens of a particular political realm. The other way would simply to conflate the two and say that is part of, to some extent, the Reformed tradition. You are simply Christian, full stop, and then you just have to behave. Whether you are in one country or in the other, it's one and the same thing. And then the other option is the American option of saying the two never shall mix, the separation of church and state option. Now, I'm not sure whether that option is the best, but it looks like so far it seemed to have bought America a space in which they are able to at least have enjoy some a level of peace. But you can begin to see, for example, the way the Catholic Church as a church gets involved into the issues of Supreme Court rulings. For example, what do you do if you are an Irish person and the country adopts a constitution that protects family planning? Do you leave Ireland? That is the debate which they had early this year. How do they relate the problem of family planning and their faith question that never interfere in the natural laws of procreation and therefore don't do any contraception, don't, and you mean that is not even going to the extreme of the issue of abortion, but simply at the level of family planning, contraception, it says no ways. And that is also an example of the conflict between citizenship and discipleship. Now, there is another important way and totally different way from what I've said in which these two realms conflict, your citizenship, the dual citizenship. And this is the story of how this conflict was lived out in South Africa, the conflict of faith and politics in South Africa. This happened when politics attempts to overwhelm the life of faith, when politics tells you who should be your neighbor, what you should preach, how you should read the Bible, and all the other things related to your life of faith. In other words, when politics now no longer gives you space to live out that discipleship, then you have another example. Now, this is a very interesting way. It's this intrusion of citizenship into discipleship as it has happened in the South African situation. And it has tended, to lead to very dangerous notions of thinking that you can get your salvation, in other words, your faith goals, out of living out of being an obedient citizen. Obey the land, the laws of the land, and in so doing, God will look favorably upon you, and then you can enter into heaven. And so you see here politics, a good obedient citizen being used as a complete substitute for what discipleship means. Even if that law happened to be in conflict with the law of the of Christ, it doesn't matter. Just obey what the state says, then you have done your duty with respect to God. And this has resulted in the South African situation with a situation in the world which is unbelievably over politicized. To understand the struggle or the life of the church in South Africa, you need to understand how this discipleship and citizenship became so over politicized that all that the church did and said in conferences tended to be nothing but politics. If you are a pastor in South Africa and you are a good, maybe you look after old age people well and so on and so on, under that situation there is a tendency to think that you are not a good pastor because you don't do anything political, because the thing had already started from the over politicization of all the realms of life in such a way that the only way to become a true pastor is to be seen to be resisting this intrusion of politics into faith. That is why most South African clergy persons at the same time tend to become political activists, tend to become political preachers and all those things. And in the end, this reaction to the politicization of South African life, it also leads to the faith becoming too much one-sided. And you've got it again, the conflation of politics and rather citizenship and so on. Therefore, you have this what I call two extremes of a politics that wants to get involved, to take over faith, and a faith that defines all it says about around politics. And then you saw faith which leads people to politics because politics was attempting to take over faith. I will conclude this by asking whether, number one, can there be a coexistence between the two forms of citizenship, discipleship and worldly citizenship, without any conflict happening between them? Can there be a harmonious coexistence? It's a question I'm posing to you. And as part of that question, I'm asking whether, where in your situation do you see concrete forms of this conflict, and how do you think they should be resolved?
State, you don't have dual citizenship there. You're Muslim, and that's the church and the state. So you really can't even discuss dual citizenship. You're born Muslim. You can never leave that. And it's a little different than you're describing in South Africa, where the government, or the politics. You're saying if you lead the life of a good citizen, therefore you'll be rewarded through the church, through, and go to heaven. There, if you live the life of Muhammad, then of course you're automatically a good citizen. So there's not the conflict there, because there's not the dual citizenship. I think when you have the dual citizenship in South Africa and the United States, then conflict is inherent. And that it's the only way maybe you'll do away with not having the conflict is maybe in a place like where the church and the state are one, because it's a single role.
Mm.
Could I ask you though, is the way the, when you take a religious doctrine like Muslim and then make it the rule of a political entity, does it in some ways distort what the spiritual message is? You know, I'm wondering, once you do that, just because I think that's what happens to Christian principles when that is done. Do you think that the same thing happens with the Muslim? Once it becomes the law of a secular society, does it lose some of its spiritual importance? And it really isn't then truly true to its spiritual message? Or is it more a totally political sort of message?
I don't know. I mean, just from an outsider looking in, like you used the word fundamentalist, talking about the Quran. The Muslims that I would know would say, I'm a fundamentalist, because it's, to be a fundamentalist is to worship five times a day and to eat the foods I'm supposed to eat and read the Quran. That's a fundamentalist, but I'm also very liberal. And so to them, there's not the conflict of being a fundamentalist versus a liberal or conservative. It's just a way of life. I haven't been there long enough, and I haven't studied it, but it's just a way of life. There's not the separation.
But I think that even there, you still have you are going to have a problem of how Islamic economy, for example, has to relate to Western economy. If they borrow money from a bank in New York, are they going to, if somebody borrows money, are they going to demand interest, which immediately becomes contrary to the law of the Quran?
Right. They've gotten around that because they don't call it. I mean, obviously the Muslims there put money, but it's not in a bank, and I don't know, they've got a separate name, and they don't call it interest, it's called something else. So, you know, they moved into the 20th century in that way.
Yes.
It's also society that's 60% Muslim, 30% Chinese, 10% Indians. So they've got a lot of different religions there, and of course Christians. I don't mean to draw away from
that. Yes, no, sure, thank you. Thank you.
I think this is along the lines of what you're asking. Tell me whether it is or not. But
no.
I heard an Iroquois chief speak. I think it was Iroquois. He was chief of the six tribes or whatever, but it was back in the Midwest. And he was talking about, we made a real mistake when we separated church and state, when we drew up our constitution and things. And he felt that way because there was no spiritual center to how we made our political decisions. And I think we're seeing that now in our ecology and what we're doing with the world, because we aren't making decisions based on anything spiritual, but it's based on where we can get the bucks the fastest, you know? Is that kind of...
No, I'm actually saying the opposite. I'm saying that if you try to rule the state from, and in some ways, I don't know if any of you heard Fred Nagel this morning, but I think he was talking about the temptations of Christ, and when the devil offered Christ the opportunity to have control over the nations of the world, and he said, rather than highlighting the part about, well, this is my interpretation, but highlighting the having to worship the devil, but just looking at the idea of anytime you start trying to rule, that maybe, in a sense, you are, it's a false sort of hope. And I guess I've heard people talk in the saying, we aren't really understanding Islam in some ways because it's being distorted by the realms that have appropriated it and are using it for a way to rule people.
And maybe the key is not trying to rule, and maybe that, maybe the Native American way is not necessarily ruling as much as just daily, each person daily living.
I think your question is still valid, though. Do people think, or can they say, a mistake was made, or was it the right thing to do? I think that is still a
to
debate.
Separate
to separate church and state when that happened.
Yeah, but it seems to me, I mean, that Israel, that is their premise, that they would like to have their state and church, you know, I mean, totally one and ruled. And when you do that, eventually anybody that's got some different ideas or different beliefs, they don't fit in. I mean, it's like you squash them. They have to, you know, I mean, they have to believe like you do to prosper, and they have to and so in some ways I think I believe in that separation of church and state, because eventually what I think, which I think was coming out of this too today, is that if you have the church being that whole, I mean, part of the state, it's like it becomes too, that power almost corrupts it, you know? I don't know. I mean, I don't think you then, maybe there's a, you know, this isn't a perfect world, and I don't think it allows for the people with differences.
Mm-hmm. And yet I think when you live from a non-spiritual center and your decisions are made based on something other than that inner spiritual voice, whether it's making money or what, then you get messed up too.
Oh, so I agree with that, but then see, I think...
What do we do?
Okay, but then I think then that's where you, as a Christian, I mean, that's where we need to... It's not that our ideas are wrong and that you don't have a spiritual center. I mean, I know what you're saying and I agree with that, but people can have that spiritual center and you can get your message to other people and you can love other people and care for them and help them to realize that we shouldn't make our decisions based on the almighty dollar, but on other things, but that doesn't have to be mandated.
Yeah, I think that what you are saying, that one example is how religious life was like taken out of the even the secular life of the Eastern Bloc countries, especially those who were communist. So you had there the taking out of God and to make everybody just a citizen. Now that is one example. But then the other examples are those countries which also try to say, make your discipleship a private matter for yourself. In other words, be a kind person, love and so on. But once you go there in business, be a director of a corporation. If you've got to make a decision that makes hundred of people lose their jobs, that is the realm now of business or politics or what. And then 5 o'clock, switch off the lights in the office, go home. So that there is then a distortion in my understanding of the private and the public realm of integrating, making it that. But the issue here is that one works with several extremes. You work with one extreme, which thinks that the church and state should not overlap. Your decision on abortion should have nothing to do with what the church, with your discipleship. Now, which is, I think, is wrong, because I think that a true understanding of discipleship can still inform a person to be either very humble on those cases of which relate abortion and say, you know, I've never been in that situation. And I would rather not pass judgment on a person who's confronting that. Or for that matter, to begin to relate it with many other things. But that person doesn't mean that he says church has nothing to do with this. And then there is the other case which says that the Bible as the church says this is evil, full stop. And so you have a various dimensions.
And then you get the extreme, which Sue was talking to, which is everybody has to think like me, believe like me, so I can't accept people who are of a different faith.
Okay. Yeah.
And if you live in my country, you have to think like me down this narrow
exactly.
line.
Yes.
Well, you know, practically speaking, in the United States, you know, our freedom of religion is one of our fundamental principles. And so if you have a number of different religions, which we do, you know, who's going to decide which religion is going to be in charge? So you practically speaking, you have to have separation of church and state.
Yeah.
And the beliefs of those people, when they are in public office, you know, hopefully they're the good qualities of their particular religion, you know, will shine through in some way and benefit in a positive way the political decisions that they make. But I guess firmly believe that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Except on the other hand, I think it's kind of complicated in the United States because I think we have been taught that we are a Christian nation. And so that I think you were asking what is the experience of conflicts within
yes.
our own lives of being, well, I think the Gulf War was a good example. That I think when the time led up to that Gulf War, there were a lot of us as Christians who were out there in different sorts of ways of asking for war not to be the way, you know, out on the streets and doing things. When that decision was made by the state, it was amazing the feeling that happened within the church, within almost, I would say, 95% of Americans, the feeling of hostility towards people who continue to feel that their faith called for them to say that was a wrong decision. Once the state made its decision, it was a real palpable change within our country, and there was a sense in which, and I think what complicates that is our sense that we are a Christian country, and when we finally come to a decision that should be a right decision for Christians too. I think it's real subtle. We talk about church and state being separated, and yet I think all of us like to think of this as a Christian country with good intentions. So, after all this debate, we allow all this free freedom to go out and say what should, you know, everyone gets their chance. But once the state decides, then it's not okay. And I mean, it really was a palpable difference.
I don't think it was anywhere near 95%, though. I mean, at least
no,
in our
just
area,
for a
I would
short
say it would have been 55-60%.
Yeah, and I think it's
kind of...
Yeah, I know.
but I think that one should also obviously give credit to the fact that an attempt was made, at least by other people, to say where they stand and then to comply with a decision after it was formally or democratically decided. Now, this is a question where now it also relates to this whole discipleship. Can you, even if this is your belief, because you see, a Mennonite wouldn't have given in even after the proper legal ways have been followed, because he would say that Christ calls me under all circumstances not to do this. And if I am to imitate him, this is what I would do. And that is a different understanding of citizenship. Now, my interest, there's a final question, is this other conflict, which I say is similar to what happens in South Africa, where disciples, in the sense of pastors, become political activists.
Can I go back one step?
Okay.
You were talking about Mennonites?
Yes.
Because like the Amish, they don't take part in a lot of our society. They live separately. If they're involved in court things, they won't go to court. Mm-hmm. They don't take part in our legal system.
Mm. And if there was a war, they would be conscientious objectors, which is okay.
And they choose to live separate and stay to themselves. So is that really being a part of society?
It says that they need to be part of society. That's what the freedom of the Constitution and not establishing a religion or anything was granting, is that everybody had that right in any way they wanted it.
And they also choose not to vote, usually.
Yeah.
But then they're living in a country but not taking part in a lot of decisions.
But that for other people, just by living in the country, at least they are indirectly enjoying some of its benefits. Or at least it's some of its protections. It is not, in other words, it's a complex issue whether is it right for a person not to to take part in that way, for example,
and still receive the protection
and still receive some of it. It's an a voting right.
What
is part of an
obligation, right.
Yes. And then if you enjoy some of the rights, at least you should bear. But then that also for them, of course, that is not a problem. They can do many things which many other Christians would not be willing to do as part of what they're willing to do for the state. I mean, you are dealing with people who are very, very, they are not simply just taking advantage. They are very sincere in what they are doing. It's simply that they define it in such a way that it leaves no room for compromises or gray areas.
At least they have a conviction in something that they're going to. It's the 60% of the people who take no part otherwise just because of apathy that
yes.
we can really be concerned about.
Exactly.
It's a very difficult question, and I certainly don't know the answer, but I think one of the reasons that we have separation of church and state is, you know, the history of the European countries and how this has led to such a terrible problem that they had this many wars. You have to remember the German was Lutherans, and that there was not a separation of church and states, and we were in on that. And I guess I would go as far as to say that if we had a non-separated church and state and we were Lutheran, I would not want to be a part of that.
You see, here in the United States, there's a microcosm where church and state are very intimately linked, and that's in many parts of the state of Utah, where I think there's a debate where you can call the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints a Christian church, and my Roman Catholic mother, who lives in Salt Lake City, would say they're not. But the point is that church and state are very, very close. And the further you get away from the temple in downtown Salt Lake City, the more strongly linked are church and state, where they still practice polygamy, 20 miles from the state capital, where all social programs, all social activities, all political officers are chosen in the church. They say, Sam, you and Ben are going to be running for mayor. You know, it is dictated in many ways, as we were discussing yesterday in your seminar, is that the church and state are very, very close to them.
Mm-hmm. And of course, that goes into the business community. We had a friend who's a lawyer who worked in the law office there. Her husband was on the faculty university, and there was only so far she could go as a lawyer in the law firm because, of course, the law firm was Mormon, and the partners were well up in the church, and there would be other people coming behind her and move on because she was A, a woman, and B, not a Mormon. So they left. But there's an example of church and state going into the business. It's a whole community as well.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I think the final thing I should say is that In struggling with this issue, we came to it in South Africa from the point of view of, on the one hand, being denied citizenship and struggling for it. And the motivation for struggling for it, interestingly enough, was simply because of our discipleship. It was because of faith in God who calls us to responsibility to the political realm, to say that you have to stand up and say that law is not in accordance with God, no matter whether the person who made it is a legitimate authority. And that faith led us into politics. So I was trying to show that this whole thing is so complex that sometimes you can get into it from the other direction of being a non-citizen and still begin to fight. But then the important thing was what I asked, whether can the whole thing be in harmony, because that's where the politics is. People think that after liberation, the church no longer has as the one that tries to define every occasion what citizenship means. The church at every point in history has a responsibility to constantly redefine what citizenship means. It may mean one thing in the 60s and another thing in the 80s. The issues that you raised about ecological consciousness could be one of the important challenges of citizenship today. In the same way as possibly hunger or so could have been an issue in another area. So you have that there could never be a time when a person can just simply live a whole comprehensive life just as a citizen. You need to have the infusion of discipleship that informs you, that sets limits. But then that discipleship should not take over this other realm, in the same way as the realm of citizenship must not take over the discipleship realm. And this is where the struggle of faith and politics relate, the salvation and liberation objective. A state cannot save, only discipleship saves. And yet at the same time, discipleship does not may entail that you get into the structures that make life, the political realm, just what other people can say, liberatory. And this is the struggle between faith and politics that I had. Thank you.
There's a forum there's a 9 o'clock forum tonight.
Yes, there's a 9 o'clock forum on citizenship in America or something like that. I'm not sure. Ted Peters will be there, and then with his knowledge of the diversity of America today, it should be a very interesting forum as to what it in America. Maybe many people understand it differently, and the crux of the matter is that how does this impact on our faith? And the other thing is that even in Muslim countries, that debate is still going on. For example, Damascus is an example of a Muslim state that tries to remind Muslims to not to take that discipleship into, to set limits to discipleship into this. So what are called secular Islamic states are trying to do that. And the other reality of the matter is that as the Western world, whether in the form of Christianity or just in the form of popular American culture, make inroads into some of these well-protected Islamic cultures and traditions, there is going to be, because suddenly somebody is going to say, I want my child to be taught in this school, and no imam is going to tell me otherwise. And in the same way that the Puritan American life started to break after the early settlement, you're going to find the same thing happening. And then they're going to begin to write books about this conflict also. Thank you.
Thank you very much.